Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a spotlight episode, and I'm joined by one of my favorite creators, Jimmy Palmiotti, is on the show again. So, Jimmy, welcome back. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks, buddy. Great. Thank you for having me again. It's usually they never have me again after the first time, so I'm happy about this.
Well, yeah, we got a lot to talk about. You know, you and I have been threatening for years to get on the show and talk about one of my favorite things that you've ever done, from the writing to your collaborators on interior art and the covers. It's 21 Down. You wrote it. Jesus Ayala is on the interiors. Beautiful Joe Jusco covers. And it ended before its time. So we definitely had to get you on to finally talk about 21
Down. Yeah, it comes up every once in a while, because sometimes out of nowhere somebody goes, hey, you know, you guys were going to do a second year of that, and what happened? Or I heard there was more. Or actually, recently, I think you saw it, I posted some pages from number 13, which I wasn't supposed to post, but who cares? So it was one of those books that I think you can maybe still find the trades, probably on eBay, unless on Amazon. I don't think they're in print anymore. And it's also one of the few properties that Justin and I created that we tried to get the rights back to. We keep trying to get the rights back and you know, so we can own it and all this stuff. But it seems like there's somebody up there that keeps going, no, we want to make 21 Down into a TV show. And they never give me the rights back. But honestly, nothing's ever been done.
Yeah, so, I was going to ask you about that, because I did see, you know, obviously we heard all the news that came out recently about DC and some of the changes, you know, coming down from Warner Media, a lot of it to do with the AT&T acquisition, and, you know, they're $160 billion in debt. So, but I did see some creators saying that now may be the time that they may be willing to let some things go, but God knows what price they would ask, you know?
In the past, when they let things go, like Monolith, I own Monolith back again, right? Mm-hmm. And I own the Twilight Experiment. Mm-hmm. They gave me back. And, you know, so they gave me a couple of things back. There was never the Resistance, you know, was another thing that we got back. We owned. So there was never a price. They never charged us. What the deal is, if it's out of print, they're not doing anything with it, they don't care about it,
right?
Why not give it back to me? They never, you know, with the Resistance and Monolith, they never really worked the characters into their other books. I'm not a big name creator for them, right? So I'm one of the grunts, you know. I work for them, of course, once in a while, like Jonah Hex or Harley or Power Girl happens. But they never treated me, you know, like a top writer there, right? Mm-hmm. So I get the properties back. That's the good news, right? Like, I'd love to get G.I. Zombie back personally, and I'd love to get 21 Down just so I could put out the 13th issue that we did, because it's fully drawn. It's fully written and it's fully drawn. Yep. It's not colored and it's not lettered, right? And I've asked Jim Lee a couple of times, hey, can we print this, or can you put it in the back of an annual? And you know, the answer's always been, well, it doesn't really fit. And, you know, I have the original art here and I sit with it, you know,
yeah.
And one day I'm going to just, like, you know, I'll change all the dialogue and make it a one shot that makes no sense to anyone. But, you know, when we were hired, so this was like, you know, so 21 Down and the Resistance came out at the same time, right? And it was Bob Harris just got a job at Wildstorm, editing for Wildstorm, and they asked him to bring in new properties. And he came to me and Justin and said, do you have anything? And I said, yeah, we actually have a couple of ideas. And he liked the 21 Down and he liked the Resistance. And those are the two books we did for that Wildstorm group. And Resistance lasted only 7 or 8 issues. Resistance would probably do much better now, because when it came out, it was one of those books that was like, it was one of the most diverse comics ever made, you know?
Right. Yep.
And it was a little adult in concept, and it kind of makes more sense now. But 21 Down was sort of like, I think I like to compare it to the show Medium in a way, you know, which came after the fact. But it was basically about a kid who knew, who had the power that he knew he was going to die at 21. And, but he had this power that lasted for the last year of his life was going to go, you know, and the FBI assigns an agent to kind of babysit him, you know, and they use the power to solve some murders. And unfortunately his brother gets involved in one story and everything. And it was just an unusual, Justin and I just came up with the idea and we ran with it. And like all comics that nobody was reading, we kind of did anything we could and had fun with it. But it definitely was not a book people were picking up very much. And then Joe Jesko is a buddy of mine. And I told Joe, I said, you know, I want to do the covers like sort of like a Robert McGinnis paperback book to it. You know, like these really beautiful painted representations of what's going on, like a paperback. And that's where we had the unusual, like the way it was like framed on the cover with a lot of
almost white. like a letterbox almost.
Yeah, like a letterbox thing. And so it was us experimenting, and it's funny because the flip side, we were doing a Resistance at the same time, and the Resistance was nothing like 21 Down.
Yeah,
it was like a multi-image cover with different creators, and we had Juan Santa Cruz was doing the artwork, and it was complicated and a very complicated world. It was New York like 1,000 years from now, and mermaids were in strip joints, and there was an underground the people that lived in the higher buildings had more money, and the less money you had, you lived lower. And it was sort of like our very, very post-apocalyptic weird sci-fi Blade Runner / everything but the kitchen sink kind of thing. We had a lesbian relationship, we had a guy that was an alcoholic, and we actually modeled the main kid after Tintin, you know. And it was definitely Wildstorm going, just do whatever you want. And we really did whatever we want. And it didn't last long. Same thing with 21 Down. But 21 Down, actually, Jim Lee said he wants to do his second season. So it would have been like issue 13 to 24. And we got the okay that the series was going to be continued because the people liked it. And then we finished the first issue. We were working on the second one when we got the call. And they said, no, they decided they're going to cancel it. And I was like, why? And they're like, oh, we just don't think it has enough audience. So we actually had an issue that was done that never saw the light of day. And it's actually a really good issue. I mean, it's one of our best ones, actually. But it just basically followed the main character kind of stepping away from the girl from the FBI and seeing, like, what kind of life he has left. And it had sort of a bit of a deadline. You know, this is a character that was living on a deadline. So, but that's comic books. I mean, you know, G.I. Zombie for me was another book like that where it only lasted, six or eight issues. And it was, I would love to get that back because I think Warner Brothers have lost their mind that they didn't make a film or a TV show from that property.
Yep.
Is beyond me. Like, I don't know how you can't make that into something. That was Dan DiDio going, you know what? That's a great idea. Just make a comic. And I got Scott Hampton, did beautiful, beautiful work on it. Mm-hmm. For me, it was Zombie James Bond. But
yeah, that's exactly what it is.
You know, but I don't know why it didn't. I think maybe because they had iZombie, nobody wanted to look at it. I don't know. You know, I do a lot of weird books that people don't read or... or I like to say I have a very limited audience for some of the work I do. You know,
you know what I think it is? Because, you know, you talk about G.I. Zombie, you talk about 21 Down. Those are literally two of my favorite things you've ever done. And like you said with the Resistance, if it had come out now, it's all a matter of timing. You just don't have the best timing, Jimmy.
I maybe when I die, like all this stuff will become like really popular. And I don't know. But I have to look at, like, say, Harley Quinn and say, all right, my timing was dead on there.
Yeah, you know? You're right.
Yep. It was the right time to do it. And even Jonah Hex on some level, it was like we came back, We did Done in Ones. It's not my fault the movie was terrible. My comic was much better than the movie.
Yep.
And even with Power Girl, when Justin and I got on Power Girl, it was a character nobody really cared about. And the first thing Justin and I did is we said, why should we care about her? And we sat there and we really thought about it. Like forget what she looks like, forget the body, forget the suit, forget where she came from. Why would I read a book about her? Like, what would make it interesting? And I just said, she's an alien and she's like trying to settle in. And that's always a fun story. It's somebody trying to fit in. It's like always a great story. Yep. And that's how, and then we got the gift of having Amanda draw it. And it was like, all of a sudden, people were like, oh, I like Power Girl. Power Girl was always a character that, guys that didn't get breastfed were really big fans of,
Yeah. Yeah. She was like a joke.
Yeah. But we wanted to make her something else,
Yeah. And it works. And again, I mean, you guys, you say you're not, the biggest name creator, but you do have your dedicated following. And I know a lot of people who are fans of your work, and almost all of us are, 21 down, 21. We always talk about it. So we hope someday that maybe you will get a chance to continue that story. But you were mentioning kind of about you used Medium as an example of kind of the same story structure that 21 Down had. Had that underlying idea of Herod and him going after these people on their 21st birthday. Then you did have kind of the episodic, like you mentioned, they were solving crimes. So did you have it all planned out in terms of, we had some more small arcs to do, but you knew who Herod was and we were going to get that answer? Well, did you know the end of the story?
Well, so what happened was the guys at Wildstorm, Jim and the guys, thought we need to bring in some of the Wildstorm universe. Mm-hmm, otherwise, nobody's going to care about it.
Right, that was it.
We weren't crazy about doing that, to be honest with you, because we were trying to create a world where there weren't any of these superheroes. It wasn't about superheroes. It was regular people who could do extraordinary things. And so in the last couple of issues, we brought in some of the Wildstorm universe, but honestly, that's not where we would have wanted to go.
Mm.
Okay. Because I felt like, I just felt like we've seen so much of that stuff already. I don't know, I'm kind of, it's kind of exhausting. Comics are kind of exhausting. And superpowers, my thing is, the reality of superpowers isn't the same as the comic books thing. I think I was looking at some new series that...
Donnie Cates?
Yeah, Donnie Cates is doing. And I was like, where it's like, what if you really had powers? And I'm like, okay, yeah, we've said everything we had to say in the pro about what if somebody had real superpowers. Yeah. But the idea with 21 Down was like, what if a kid was just in a circumstance and his whole world was kind of rocked by this, And this older woman who he was obviously infatuated with on some weird level understood, like, it was just a complicated story. It was not a simple, guy has superpowers, guy does this. It was a very complicated, complex adult relationship in the book. And honestly, I'm always creating comics for me that I feel like there's no representation of what I want to read. So I'm always creating things that I think I want to read. And problem with that is not everybody else wants to read it all the time.
Well, I mean, yeah, I wanted to read it. And from just to give you kind of my perspective on it, it's interesting to hear you use that word complicated. So certainly the situation Preston, the main character, is in is a messy situation. And certainly it starts out, it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that the Wildstorm tie-in stuff was brought in later, because the way it starts out, it's a little messy, but it's very clean storytelling. You're not trying to go, this huge bombastic story. It's very focused and it's very clean. And I did feel like once you started having to bring in, or you did bring in some of those Wildstorm influence and references, it wasn't quite as clean. It wasn't quite as
focused. I prefer the intimate story. It's funny because if you really read G.I. Zombie, it's sort of a continuation of 21 Down in a weird way, because it is the male-female relationship.
Yep.
They're kind of together, and she is, like, it's funny because G.I. Zombie, it's flipped. The roles have flipped a little bit. You know, and it's I'm always fascinated. The male-female setup is always interesting to me. And it's it look, if they gave me Lois Lane to write, it would be an interesting book, you know, because I would be looking at the idea of how Lois looks at Superman, the idea that she's her boyfriend is the most powerful guy in the universe and what she has to do in order to deal with that.
Yeah.
It's funny because I pitched a Batman book that was about Alfred and the people that Alfred would hire when Bruce would go, like, would be Bruce, you know? So he'd hire an escort for the evening to make Bruce look like a bachelor. And Amanda and I pitched a series about the women that Bruce hired, that Alfred hired. And no bites on it yet. But I was just like, because to me, Batman is more, Bruce is actually more interesting to me, because Batman's very well defined. And, but what Bruce wants out of life isn't, you know, and you can't say Bruce just wants to be Batman all the time because it doesn't really work. And Alfred, of course, has his ideas of how he thinks Bruce should conduct his life.
Right.
That doesn't jive with Bruce either. And I thought, okay, that might be more interesting. But like I said, we haven't had any bites. Amanda and I pitched it a couple of times, and we always pitch weird stuff. I got to be honest with you. Like, 90% of the things Amanda and I pitch, they don't take, because we definitely have a different perspective on what we want to see. And it's never normal. You know, I get it. You want to do Batman, you want to put the Joker in it. I get it, but I've seen it a billion times. I'm not interested in
three. I agree.
I don't care about three Jokers. I don't care. Like, whatever that storyline is, by the time it's done, I'll just be happy it's gone.
Yep.
You know,
I agree.
Whenever I write something, it comes with a bunch of, depending on my editor, it comes back with notes. You know, the people who trust me leave it alone. The people who don't always have their notes. I'm not a great person with notes.
This Alfred pitch, is it? Would you guys be coming at it from a humorous aspect or more serious, or a blend of both?
It would be a little bit of both. It would be sort of like an observation-y thing. You know, it's sort of, we would see it from the point of view of the women that get hired and how they deal with Alfred and how Alfred deals with them. So it's not really a Batman book, you know? Right. I don't know. It sounds like a backup, but honestly, I think there's a way we would do it where it would be actually very empowering and very interesting. But you know, at the same time, Amanda and I talk a lot, and like, we need to do our own comics. So we're pitching a lot less these days and focusing on our own work a lot more.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of people doing that recently. And I know the pandemic is part of that. But the one last thing I'll say about that Batman book is it sounds a little Gotham Central, you know. It's not a Batman book. It's just set in that.
And that
was critically acclaimed. So we know those types of stories can work.
Yeah, no. And it would be very focused on Bruce. You know, we need to know what Bruce, like I said, Bruce has to put on this facade. You know, the real mask in Bruce's life is Bruce Wayne. It's not Batman, right? Because otherwise he'd be, if it was night all the time, he'd be Batman all the time.
Yep.
The actual costume he's got to put on is to be Bruce Wayne at this point. And so it would be a study of that. And it would be a study of, like, how does the, you know, it's funny. I've written Batman in a lot of things, but the only time I've ever written a Batman story was for the DC 100 pages, the 100 page giants for Walmart. And I wrote issue 1 and 2, and then Bendis took over 3 on, right? But I did 1 and 2. And I wrote a story, I rewrote the origin of the, with the parents and when they got killed, the night they got killed. from Bruce's point of view, like looking up at his parents and seeing them laughing during the Zorro movie and having a good time. And I just said, well, I have a little bit to add here, because the idea that his mom was laughing the way his dad made his mom laugh was something he always remembered. And it's just, it was just me putting myself into remembering my parents, and I put it into that story. And it was like a, I think it was like a 12-page story, two 12-page parts. And but I finally got to write like a little Batman story, you know, because they don't give a guy like me Batman. They give me like all the weird stuff, you know. And I wrote a super clean Superman story. I wrote a story where he, for the DC 100s number one and two, I wrote Superman going to Tornado Alley and dealing with the families that lived there as Clark Kent. And so I got to write those two. So I really, like, it gave me my, like, okay, I got that off my plate. I'm kind of okay now, you know, got it out of my system.
Well, I'm sure.
I think the only one I have left is Fantastic Four is really the one book I need to write one day.
See, I think I'd love a Batman run by you, or Superman run by you, and a Fantastic Four run by you. I think your sensibilities, your writing sensibilities, just appeal to me so much. And I don't know, maybe it's just because, you know, like you, I've been a comic fan for so long. You know, it comes to Joker right. And Batman, it's like, okay, been there, done that. Let me see some new stuff.
I think you're also an adult. And you know, having an adult perspective on things, it's hard to reread the same things over and over and over, right?
Because, right. Yep.
So when you get to that point, you're like, okay, I need to see something I haven't seen before. Amanda just walked in.
Hello.
Hi, Amanda. Good to see you.
Good to see you. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing fine.
How's your parents?
In there?
They're doing well. I've been working all. Whenever, so it's good for me to like get up off my behind. And
that's it. Get out of the house once in a while.
Get out of the house every so often. So.
Yeah.
I gotta get back to work.
Okay, sweetheart. Thanks for stopping by.
Good to see you. Yeah, but we were mentioning, you know, so many creators doing creator-owned stuff, taking advantage of this time and kind of some of the challenges the comic industry is facing right now. But you've been doing it for a long time successfully on Kickstarter, and you actually have a Kickstarter that ends in a week from today as we record this. And everybody listening, as soon as I get done with Jimmy, I'm gonna edit it and get it up tonight for you all. So the last day is the 28th. Of August to
next Friday
to pledge for Pop Kill number 2, which is his creator-owned project. And if you miss number 1, there are tiers in the campaign for number 2 where you can get number 1 and number 2. I got number 1, read it, loved it. So why don't you tell our listeners, Jimmy, what the story of Pop Kill is all about?
Sure. Pop Kill is it's a 4-issue book. So by the time it's done, it's like 100 and something pages. It's a pretty big book. It's like 138 or 40 something pages. It's basically about, so these, it's competing soda companies owned by conjoined twins that were separated and hate each other. So they form a soda company and they compete with each other. And the main story is about the guy they hire, like the James Bondish kind of really male, very male kind of guy they hire to steal the secrets from the other companies. And then he gets involved with the person that he's supposed to go after. And it's very, you know, a lot of it's very, very Steve McQueen, Faye Dunaway, kind of 60s spy drama thrown in with some crazy, two crazy guys that hate each other. There's a lot of espionage. It's an adult book, so there's a little bit of nudity. There's some violence and language. It's not for the kids. And it's just an adventure and a bizarre thing. It was something that Dave Johnson actually pitched me. He said, what about a story with competing soda companies? And I was like, how does that work as a comic? And then we started finding the comic book elements of it. Like the whole third issue is the origin of the brothers, which is hysterical. But we did it as a we started putting it together, and then I had Juan Santa Cruz, who I worked on the Resistance with and Twilight Experiment with, and he was available, and he's been drawing, and he just finished the third issue, and he's on the fourth one right now. But the artwork is beautiful. With the Kickstarter, we kind of packaged it. You got your first issue. It's like, there's no expense that's spared on this. Like, it's the best printing I can get. It's the best everything I can get for the book. It's fun. It's unique. It's very limited edition because we only print for the Kickstarters. And issue two right now, you can buy it and get issue one if you want. So you get one and two. I sign every copy. So every copy comes with a signature from me. And then we have a certificate of authenticity, which normally doesn't mean much, except these, we actually scan them. So we actually know where every book goes.
Wow, that's cool.
Which is really crazy. And then it's got a little holographic number, and we scan that and then to each address that we're sending it to. But you know, it's definitely not something it would have been an easy sell for a comic company.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because I like a little nudity. I like my books to be adult. I feel like nudity, violence, and language, that's part of telling a story. So that's like our lives. Our lives should have plenty of nudity, violence, So that's out. We got a week left on it, and we hit our mark. I think if we hit 50,000, everybody gets a digital copy. When you back it, you get a digital copy, and then we're almost at the 50,000 mark where I think I'm gonna put a Trailblazer graphic novel, a digital one, to everybody. So everybody gets we tried to make the stretch goals a lot of digital stuff. So when you get the book, you'll get a lot of stuff to read. My thing is, I want to just bombard you with comics. And so far so good. The people who actually backed the first one actually backed the second one, and that's always a good sign.
I mean, like I said, I back all your Kickstarters because they're good stories, they're quality stuff, and like you said, you're always throwing in extra stuff. But I wanted to ask you about the collaborative process with Dave Johnson. Most people know him as an artist, and he's doing the covers for these, and they look great. But you got Juan Santa Cruz to do the interiors, which are beautiful. He draws action like really, really well. So what's the process been like collaborating with Dave? I feel like he's probably over there just like soaking this writing stuff, your writing mojo, in like a sponge. Has it been a lot of fun?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Dave is very he's super creative. Obviously one of the most visual, I think he's one of the top 10 comic book cover artists in comics. I think he's just amazing. But he's got a lot of ideas, you know, when he's a friend of mine. So the idea, when a friend comes and says, let's do something together, you almost want to do it, right? You want to do it out of the gate because it's just going to be fun. And when Dave hit the concept, he had all this crazy stuff, and it's in the book. There's a lot of, like, Dave wrote a lot of it. And I think I was more of a wrangler and dialogue person, you know, because Dave would be like, how about we do this? How about we do that? And I would be, okay, we need to wrangle all that and make it a linear story so people can have a beginning, middle, and end. But he's got so much enthusiasm, and the enthusiasm comes through with the work. And his covers are just beautiful. I mean, every cover on his... He did the four covers already, and they're just stunning. But it was a great opportunity to work with Dave. You know, he needs to write more. He's like one of those creators that he needs to write and draw more. We definitely... What happens to a lot of creators is people put them in categories and they never bounce out of them. You know, Dave is a cover artist, but he can do interiors too. And, you know, it's funny because when it's really scary for an artist to get out of their safe zone.
Right.
And, you know, so writing is not his safe zone. So having a partner to write it with, it sort of helps, you know. But I think he's ready to go and do his own thing after this. I just feel like, I definitely school people on some level. I don't mean to do it. It's just that I have a way of looking at things. Dave's always had his own voice. So I think after this, he'll probably do some cool stuff. But I'm so happy to have him for this project. And like I said, as the pages come in for the fourth issue, I'm so happy with this because it's just beautiful looking. Juan is like fantastic on it. I cannot be having Brian Reber doing the coloring, like, and John J. Hill on the design and the lettering. I mean, we have like the great team, and I keep John J. Hill for everything I do. He's like my guy, my go-to guy to put everything together. because he's one of those guys, he's like me, he's a visceral person. The book has to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be, you know, my spot varnish has to be right. My color has to be right. I check the black levels on the interiors. Like, all these little things drive me crazy about regular comics, that these people have millions of dollars, but they can't make the book. They can't put a spot varnish on it for 1 cent more to make the book better. And it's been my whole career. It's like, even Marvel Knights was me saying we can do it better.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least with the Kickstarters, I have to put my money where my mouth is.
With yeah, these. That's and, for sure.
I'm always trying to get stuff better, the work better, the art better, the packaging better, and more creative. And the Kickstarters allowed me that opportunity because it shows me that there's an audience for unusual storytelling. And I don't really need to sell a million of these things. I just need to sell 1,000 and I'm happy as a clam.
Yeah, well, I know you're happy to get the story out there. And the other part I'll mention about working with Dave is, you know, you made that transition yourself. You know, you started off, you know, as on the artistic side with inking and yes. Transitioned over. And I know you have a little bit of inking you're going back to, where we won't mention what it is, but I can't wait to find out. Something that got you back to the drawing board must be really cool. But I hear so many creators talk, and your name comes up a lot, about mentoring people and paying it forward. And I know that you had, you know, some of the old guard that did that for you, and you're passing it on. So I think you're kind of the perfect person to really kind of help Dave out. Cause I agree. I've met Dave. He's a great guy, super talented. And yeah, you got to avoid, you know, it's kind of like as an actor being typecast, right?
Right.
It limits what your opportunities are. So.
Oh yeah. I was talking to somebody today and I haven't, you know, he's a guy I knew and still know like 20, 30 years later. And he said to me, he goes, you know, you came to me and you only had penciling samples. You didn't have any inking samples. You just wanted to draw comics. And I said, yeah. And I said, what happened was the people that I was showing it didn't like my art, but they wanted to hire me as an inker. And that's how I became an inker. But the reality is I wanted to draw this stuff. I didn't want to ink. I didn't want to be anybody's inker. I wanted to actually draw this stuff and write it myself. And it took me many years to get to the writing part. And probably the drawing part will happen one day soon, because even as I'm talking to you, I'm sketching all the time because I can't help it. Like,
right.
You know, I'm just sitting here sketching away on pieces of paper. And, you know, obviously this is sound, but I'm like, you know, I keep drawing little drawings and all my post-its, and every post-it has a drawing on it. It's just the way I think too. I see what I'm writing, and it's why I've been lucky with artists, because when I write my scripts, they're made for artists, because I'm explaining my visuals. I'm explaining the scope of what I'm doing, or where the room is, or how the room is laid out. And not every writer does that. They leave it to the artist. And because I see it, I visualize it, and sometimes I sketch it for them. It's a whole different thing. So Dave is a visual person, and I think working together, I think he started to see where, okay, you know, the dialogue can tell story as well. So we don't need to repeat it in the same panel.
Right.
Whatever we see, we don't have to talk about. And whatever we talk about, we don't always have to see. And it's something that you learn over time. I learned from the great Will Eisner, Kubert, you know, Al Williamson, all those guys. They're just master storytellers. So, you know, it's a giant learning curve that when I die, I'll probably go, I got it. And then, you know, I'm
done. That'll be too late. You know, I just remembered there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about 21 Down, and you jogged my memory when you talked about, as you're writing, you're seeing it, you know, you're probably seeing it in terms of, you know, how you would illustrate it. But yeah. I wonder, at any time when you were writing 21 Down, did you ever visualize who these characters would be if you cast them in a show? If 21 Down ever was a TV show or a film?
I did. So, to put it into perspective, this was 2002, right?
Mm-hmm,
2001, yep. 2002. So I told Joe Jesko, and I told Jesus, I said the girl should look like a young Sharon Stone.
Okay. I see that.
She should have a sense of control, but she should also be very well aware of her own sexuality to the point where she uses it, weaponizes it.
Mm-hmm.
And how she gets pressed in to do things is part of the way she sells herself, you know? And he's a 20-year-old guy, so of course he's going to buy right into that.
Yeah.
So she weaponized his sexuality for him. And then as the book went on, of course, she started to like him and started to get to know him. But initially, it's very weaponized and with her. And I said Sharon Stone would be great because at the time she was like in Basic Instinct and the Schwarzenegger movie where he goes to Mars.
Total Recall.
Total Recall.
Yeah, and Mickey in the book, if anyone hasn't read 21 Down, she has very short blonde hair, so I can totally see Sharon Stone. Yeah.
Yeah, and then for the main character Preston, I just told Jesus, I'm like, handsome young guy, give me handsome young guy, give me whatever you got, you know. I was more worried about her because she had to use, you know, her body was part of the story the way. You know, and then we did that crazy story with the girl that had the power to seduce, that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that was to me, that was like what happens when your powers are sexually dangerous. You know, what, you know, because we're not going to see that in any superhero movie anytime soon, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was terrible. Even her parents were like literally send each other to the hospital over that sexual attraction.
Yes, it was like in a young man's life when they're coming into their age and everything, it's like this intoxicating power to sexuality, and I wanted to take it like so far, like you almost can't control it to a point, and again, these are adult themes, right? These are adult themes in a book that. It's funny because when the book came out, like people would review it really weirdly. Like I remember reading people's reviews and going, I don't think they know what to say about it. Like they don't know where it's going. You know, the most I used to get is people go, it's kind of clever, but I don't know where it's going. And that was like the biggest flattery you could give me is to say, I have no idea where the story is going, because I hate to say it, but 90% of the comics I read, I know where the story is going.
Yeah.
And I can't, and it's what turns me off to stuff, you know? And again, why my reading, why I always get the weird gigs and why I got Harley in a way, because Harley, they were like, it already got canceled. You know, it's in the video game that you wrote, you know, I wrote Injustice.
Yeah.
Justin. And they're like, we don't know what to do with the character. And maybe you and Amanda could do something. And I said, if you let us do what we want to do, we'll do it. And Dan DiDio said, you know what, do whatever you want. And that was, you know, when we took her away from the Joker and Amanda changed her costume and we put her in Brooklyn. And it was just somebody having enough faith in us to understand whatever we're going to do, we're going to make it more interesting. So that was, that's a great part about having, when we had Dan DiDio up there. Dan was definitely understood that let the creators kind of do their thing. You know, he's great at it.
Yeah, I love Dan, Pat, as passionate and as big of a comic nerd as you and I are. So he's definitely one of us.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad you brought up Harley. Actually, I wanted to ask you a question about that, because part of what made her so successful under you and Amanda with Chad Harden's beautiful artwork, I felt like was, and you yourself mentioned it, you took her away from the Joker. You took her out of that toxic relationship. You made her own character rather than, you know, a sidekick or a derivative character. And now we see, and I am not trying to disparage anybody's creative work whatsoever. I love James Tynan. I think he got my Writer of the Year a couple years ago, and he's great. But we do have this punchline character now who it feels like to me, okay, wait, didn't we already kind of see this and it didn't really work? And now we're getting punchline and she's Joker sidekick female again with that toxic male you know, female relationship. And I don't know, maybe it will be different. But based on what we've seen so far, it does kind of feel like it's falling back into that trope. So I don't know if you're familiar with her at all, but I just kind of was curious about your thoughts of them kind of going down this road again.
I saw there was some story where they fought and they slashed Harley's neck or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read the monthly comics. So if they created, you know, whatever character he created, I'm sure he has a plan for her. You know, it's the next new thing, right? So I always say, okay, it's the next new thing. Harley, you know, Harley was a gig where I couldn't write a character that was abused by someone.
Mm-hmm.
And Amanda and I talked when we got Harley, and I said, you know, I can't get into her head that she would keep getting abused by this guy and keep coming back. I said, I understand that's the joke of her, right? To me, it was like, I get it. She's the sidekick that gets abused and keeps coming back. But I can't make a book about a series about someone who just gets abused all the time and keeps coming back for more. Like, I don't want to write that. So our first thing out of the gate with Dan was, can I get her out of Gotham? I said, I feel like she's just another Batman supporting cast character. You know, but Punchline is a Batman supporting cast character. I said, unless I can get Harley out of Gotham, I really can't write this book. And he said, sure. And I said, well, I want to give her own supporting cast because I think everything should revolve around her. If we're going to write a series every month, it has to be about who she is, what she wants in life. You know, I have the two questions, right? What does the character want? What does the character fear? And if you can answer those, then you have a good grasp of your character, because I can answer it for Power Girl. I can answer it for Harley. And so we had to take the character and mess with it. And of course, Amanda came up with, let's change the costume all the time. And Chad did the same thing. And we just did something what we thought was natural for somebody that would get out of an abusive relationship. We had no idea it was going to strike a chord like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, issue 24 and 25 were very like thought out issues about how she was going to handle the Joker and step away from him. But I just thought, I can't be involved in a character that's abused all the time. And I only know how to write tough female characters. I don't write comics where a girl goes down an alley and gets raped. I just don't do it. I don't write the weak female. I personally think women are smarter and more level-headed than men, because we you know, and if you haven't seen that in my work yet, it's there all the time. So with Harley, we just said, well, if we're going to do this, we have to own it. We have to own this character. And we're lucky enough that it stuck. And, you know, it stuck so much that they made Suicide Squad, they made Birds of Prey. The animated series is going on to a third season. We're happy what we did stuck so much, but it makes sense that Batman universe has to come out with a Punchline or whatever, the Clown Killer or whatever all this stuff is, because they have to keep doing things like that, right? To get people the next hot thing. But unless they really sit there and get to know who she is really, like you can't just be Jason in a comic. You can't just be a guy with a knife that kills people, you know?
Yeah.
It's why the Friday 13th, like for me, it's like I'm waiting for the film where I did a Friday the 13th comic. I don't know if you ever read it.
No, I didn't. Was that for Dynamite?
It was for Wildstorm, I think.
And, oh, okay.
And I explained why Jason never died, because I had to do it, because I said, I can't write a comic where he just comes out of the lake again and starts killing again. Like, why? And I think in my comic, it dated back into when the Pilgrims first came to America, and they wanted to show they had power over the Indians that were there, and they kidnapped the shaman, and in front of the whole tribe, they slit his throat, and he kept bleeding. And what the Pilgrims didn't understand, that this was a really powerful shaman, so he kept bleeding, and it didn't stop bleeding, and it formed Crystal Lake. His blood form of Crystal Lake. So the lake itself was haunted, right? So when Jason drowns in it, the spirit in the lake makes him that he can't die, right? So that I had to explain it. I'm sure Friday 13th people hated it, but my thing is I had to figure out why is he so motivated that he has to kill all the time? Like, it was the one thing about anything. I always wanted to know why. As a kid, I was very inquisitive. Like, why? You know, I see people do crimes or people have problems, you know, and like they're alcoholics. And, you know, somebody says, well, he's an alcoholic. And the first question I go is, well, why do you think he is? Yeah. Why? What is the, what happened? You know, what was the thing that made this person escape to that? Like, what happened in their life? And how could we help that? Like, can we talk that out and analyze it? And, you know, that's the basis of all therapy, as we know. But I've always been interested in that. And that's so, for me, when I write a book, I'm always asking about the why of the character. Why is this person like that? And
as a reader, I mean, that's where we can relate to a character. I can't, if I don't know Jason's motivation and he's just a guy that's walking around on screen killing people, I don't walk around killing people. So I have no connection. Like, why am I supposed to care about this guy?
Right. And I think with Jason, it's like the connection is, of course, you're connecting to the campers.
Right.
That are just trying to have a normal life. And then this monster is coming out. You know, it's funny because I have I did a book, Random Acts of Violence, which is, as of today, it's on Shudder. Shudder, is it? I think. Is that what it's called? Shudder? Now my brain is like, I have a brain fart right now. Let me see. I think it's Shudder Network, right? Is that it?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so it's on there as of today. It's on there, and it's the Jay Baruchel did an adaptation of the book. And that was about why. Why is somebody a serial killer? Like, why? You know, and why are they okay with it on some level? You know, and the idea that you create something and it has its own life, which is what we do in comics, right? We create something and then people think it's like, oh, I want to see the character do this and I want to see it do that. And every time somebody does that, it's like Pinocchio, like it's giving life to something that we created. And it's pretty damn cool. It's the wonderful part about comics. I know we're all over the map.
No, this is, I wanted to be all over the map. This is great. And it's funny you mentioned Random Acts of Violence. So the site that hosts my podcast, LRM Online, our contributor, Manuel Gomez, got to see a pre-release earlier this week and did a roundtable with Jimmy. And there's an article up on the site about Random Acts of Violence. So if you're curious, go and check out that article.
Oh, is that posted? Jay and I did a roundtable thing. That was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Manny mentioned he was going to try to be on today, but he got stuck at work. So, speaking of jumping all over, we were talking on Twitter the other day about what you would do as DC publisher. You know, all this news came out recently with, you know, I know people that you know not there anymore, unfortunately, and we all hope they all land on their feet. And again, it's just a product of corporate America. You know, it's not that anybody deserves to lose their job or they were doing a terrible job or DC is trying to get out of the comic selling business. That's one rumor. They're going to license their characters from Marvel. All that's ridiculous. It's just a financial decision. And honestly, and you know this, Jimmy, and it kind of dovetails into why you kind of do your own, create your own stuff and self-publish. In a way, the comic industry has been a house of cards for a long time with a monopoly in distributing and not enough new readers coming in. And, you know, I talk about it all the time. It's so crazy. No other industry do you order your product before it's ever made and don't even know if it's going to be made. But it's a function of the way it is. So maybe we need this shakeup. Maybe, you know, hopefully the comic industry comes out stronger on the other side. But, you know, you kind of did it over at Marvel with Marvel Knights. So, you know, and you've been around for a long time. You know so many people. What would you do at DC if you were the publisher? Give us your first year plan.
I think my first year would be to have a discussion with licensed people and tell them that they can go license the hell out of the characters, but what we're going to do in the books is we're going to shake things up. So if you want to do your Batman and Superman license and Wonder Woman, go for it. But our job is not to worry about licensing. Our job is to worry about stories. So I would definitely make a separation between church and state right away. Because unfortunately, I think now licensing will control what they do more than stories. So the next thing I do is just get back to the pure characters, get who they are. You know, I mentioned this once, and I Darwin Cook did 52 covers. There was a Darwin Cook month. And what he represented in those 52 covers was a pure look at the core of why these characters are great. And whether you like his art or not, they were beautiful covers. And there was a joy, like there was a certain joy to the characters in his work, right? That celebrated who they were. The characters were happy to be who they were, happy to be alive, happy to be saving lives. They were real heroes, you know, like from the ground up. His Wonder Woman was like a big woman that would drink and party and save the world. And he had this really great perspective. And I think I would take the books back from to there. I would take it down to its roots, because right now all these characters have such convoluted histories that it's almost like you have to be like a mastermind to get in there and read something now, because you don't know where it's coming from. The origins have changed. And I would go back to the basic, you know, what Dan tried to do in the new 52 was introduce them from the ground up again. And I think it might be time to do that again, but just to go with the pure, to sit with everybody and go, why do I like Black Canary? Why is Green Arrow awesome? What makes him awesome? You know, why do I care about Superman? Like, what is it saying to me? Like, what is the idea, the core of it? Because what happens with these books is we get weak writers who make the books about everyone else but the main character.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, there's more stories about Lois and Jimmy than there are about Clark and Superman. Or all of a sudden, Batman books are more about the Joker and more about the bad guys and less about Bruce and Batman. So that has to be stopped, right? Because it's called the Batman. If you want to do a book about the Joker, call it the Joker and get it over with. But my thing is, you have to go back to the core of who they are, introduce a new audience, but at the same time acknowledge what came before. And I personally don't think every book has to be tied to each other so much. I get that we can all, it's like Sin City. I get all this stuff happens in this city, but they don't have to be interwound so much so that it's intimidating for a new reader. And I think there are a lot of the books are intimidating at this point. I feel like I can't pick up a Batman issue right now without knowing what happened for the last 3 or 4 issues. And I should be able to pick up any issue and run with it. But that's me. I'm also a big fan of Done in One stories. And I know people don't like those, but because they're the hardest things to write. But I think Done in Ones are brilliant. And when they're great, they're great. And I'm also done with the covers not reflecting what's inside the book. If I want a pinup of a guy standing there with his ring and make it a green, I could buy a poster, okay? I like the book. I want to know what I'm getting inside. Show me a scene from the book inside, you know? So there's like a couple of things I would do. I'd also hire the people that are passionate about the characters. I wouldn't just say, because this guy's popular, we need to put him on something. I would be like, do you have a passion for this character? Do you have an angle? Do you have something? A lot of stuff you see these popular writers on characters, you know, they're just because the character makes money.
Mm-hmm.
I could smell it a million miles away. I could tell when there's a guy in a book that he's just doing it because it's going to make some money. And I resent that. I don't like that. It always weakens a character. I think with Marvel Knights, Joe and I spent a lot of time saying, what's the right person for the right character? And they were unconventional, you know, Garth and Steve on Punisher, Jay Lee and Jenkins on Inhumans, you know, even Mark Texera and Chris Priest on Black Panther. Like, these are unconventional. They were something outside the box. But it's a, you know, I've seen people try to do the Marvel Knights thing 800 times already.
Yep.
And I always go to them, yeah, but you're missing the core thing. The core thing is the guys working on these characters have to love. There's a reason Kevin Smith did Daredevil, because he loved Daredevil. And we worked with him a lot to get that Daredevil where it was, because he never wrote a comic before.
Right.
But like when there's a passion there, that's when the product really glows. And it's why when you look at Capullo's artwork, it's so on fire all the time, because he really loves what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't even matter about the writer at some point. It's like Greg is just all on to that stuff. So it is definitely catching lightning, you know, with this stuff. But I think the right people on the right books. And I think a lot of the books right now, people just look at it as jobs, and I got to get two books in order to make my money and this and that. And unfortunately, the people who read the books also feel that way. I find a lot of the Marvel books I read, like, it looks like they're almost done by committee. Like, oh, okay, well, we need a woman, or we need somebody that has this voice. But I don't always feel the passion. I feel like it's a gig for some people. I'd rather wait for the passion on a book.
Yeah, I kind of feel, and it's interesting, because so many of the things that you talk about doing, you know, listeners may think, well, that's just nostalgia, but go back to when, you know, we were in our formative years reading the character. I mean, you really, because comics were, that was the thing you hid from people, that you read comics, you know. So those those creators back then had a lot of passion, and the covers had a scene from inside the book, and they weren't so connected, and there was a little more freedom. But there's so much truth to what you're saying, and you know, starting with a creator that's passionate about the character they're actually writing, as opposed to, I feel like now some of these creators are, they're coming in and they want to work for the big two to establish themselves, so then they can go and have a following to do their own, create their own stuff, because they do get a bigger piece of the pie. And you do see so many creator-owned and indie books right now where the creators do get a bigger piece of the pie, and they're telling the story they want to tell without restriction of corporate oversight saying, hey, you can't hurt the brand. And because they are so passionate, those books are so much better a lot of times. You can just tell that the creator is having fun rather than just writing the, you know, 1,020th issue of Detective Comics or what have you.
Absolutely. I mean, the fans really are very vocal about what they want, you know? And I think you need to listen to the fans a little more too, because they really know what they want on a book. You know, I see, you know, I spend a lot of time, because I have people talk to me all the time. They want more Harley and Ivy. You know, they always talk about, I want more Poison Ivy. And I'm just like, Jesus, just give it to them already, will you?
Yeah.
You know? It's like they're going nuts about it. And again, a lot of that is corporate comics, and they have their own issues and licenses, and they don't always have the freedom to go crazy. It's why I support when creators step out and do their own thing, because I feel like I'm getting a more pure experience. I'm getting to see what they would do if they were given the reins to do something. But we love these characters, you know. You love Spider-Man, you just love Spider-Man. It doesn't matter how many other characters come along. If you love Spider-Man, you love Spider-Man. So you hope that you get a guy like Dan Slott who freaking loves the character, and you hope they can keep him on forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, for me, it was John Romita and Stan, you know?
Mm-hmm. Spider-Man, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's look, we all have that. Like, each generation, I grew up with Kaluta Shadow, Bernie Wrightson, Swamp Thing, Paul Gulacy, Master of Kung Fu, John Buscema, Conan, Barry Smith and John Buscema, Conan, Captain Marvel by Jim Starlin, Warlock by Jim Starlin. You know, these are books that I could never picture anyone else ever doing. And when they did, it sucked.
Yeah.
And it was never good as those guys. And
yeah,
and
never wanted them to leave.
No, I mean, Jack Kirby and Joe Sinnott and Stan Lee on Fantastic Four, like, these were like lightning, you know, and it's tough, because we do have to go through a lot of comics to get to that kind of thing. And I think in a career, I think for me, I hope that, you know, we did that on some level. Somebody says, well, you know, Jimmy and Amanda and Justin on Power Girl, or Jimmy and Amanda and Chad on Harley, or, you know, you hope for that, because that's when the coupling is, the matchmaking is perfect. Yeah. But it's very rare, but I find it's very rare.
Yeah, well, it's getting more rare.
Yeah, it's getting more and more rare. I'm looking at the books, you know, my office is in a comic shop, and I look at the wall of books, and I'm opening them and flipping them, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't feel it there. I don't feel it there. I feel like this is number, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. So the searches do take me to more independent stuff because I see the passion in it. So if I took over DC, I would honestly, that's what I would be spending a lot of time with. I'd be like saying, I'd actually have I'd get all my writers and all my artists together, and I'd make them write down the top 10 things they'd want to work on. And why. I'd want to know why. And then I would start matchmaking the writers and the artists. You know,
I hope you're listening, AT&T and Warner Media. This would be perfect.
Yes.
So
it's easy. It's easy to do.
Yeah, it's just a little time. Yeah.
You know, you have to get to look. You know, it's sort of like you hire somebody to do something for you. You get to know them a little bit, then you get to know what they're capable of, and then they'll do a great job. You know.
Well. You're mentioning classic runs on characters. I don't know if you picked up Meister this week from Peter David, but Peter David, you wouldn't want to talk about a legendary run. His run on Hulk is just it for me. And he's doing the origin of Maestro, you know, the future evil version of the Hulk. So yeah. it's a 5-issue mini, and the first issue came out this week, and it was so good. It was my book of the week. So if you haven't checked it out,
That's cool. Peter back on Hulk makes sense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
You know, and speaking of connecting the characters, one thing I forgot to ask you when we were talking about Popkill, you did mention the kind of the main guy who's working for one of the brothers is this James Bond type, John Pyle.
Yes.
Is he a character that you feel passionate about? Is he more Dave's creation? And what was your inspiration?
So Dave pictured him like the guy from Mad Men, you know.
James Bond. I see that. Yeah.
Right. And I see the damaged goods that John Pyle is like this. He's so set in his way that when something is when he's thrown something that's a little different, he's not close-minded to it, but he's definitely observing, you know, he's definitely a guy that's observing that, oh, okay, that's not what I thought it was. And how am I going to look at that now? How am I going to deal with that? But he's a typical James Bond guy that's so used to having everything that when things don't go his own way, he's almost caught off guard, and he's a lot more interesting in that moment than when he's the secure kind of James Bond guy. And in the second issue, we learn that he's a little damaged because of stuff that happened to him in the second issue and the third. So the guy we saw, the confident guy with a pile of women on him, you know, flirting with the two twin sisters, we start to see where that's a little weak. It gets a little weak, and we start to see why he has that. Why he keeps everything at a distance is because he's been hurt. And it's easier to be the guy that womanizes and never cares about anything than it is for him to care about something, because there's something at risk there. And I think the James Bond movie Casino Royale caught that perfectly. You know, the reason why James had to be the cold bastard he is in a way is to protect him.
Right.
You know, and I find that interesting. Also with Dina Deluxe, you know, she's on the surface looks really simple and, you know, like in court and all this mess. But as we get to know her, we see a very, very complicated, very strong, independent woman that's playing this part a little bit because of the world she's in. So again, I think it's always about, you know, I like to think the characters have their integrity about them. And as the situations get a little dicier, we start to see that integrity come through. It's sort of like all of us, right? We have our lives and we have whatever, and then like something happens, or we have a COVID virus, or we have something. And there's a certain percentage of us take it very seriously, and we step up and we protect not only ourselves, but the people around us. And we hold on to our integrity and we say, you know what? Maybe wearing a mask isn't about just me. Maybe it's about protecting others, right? And I have enough integrity that I would never want to be responsible for getting someone else sick. Right. In a million years, I would rather get sick than be responsible for getting somebody else sick. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's integrity that comes into play. And, you know, so it's an interesting character study. The whole world is an interesting character study right now, you know?
Yep.
We have people that, you know, are standing, you know, or just can't, for some reason, stick a piece of cloth over their face.
Yeah, well, it's so, you know? It's so interesting, because the first thing I thought when I started reading Popkill and I got introduced to John Pyle, was my mind shot back to, I don't know if you're familiar with the series from Garth Ennis and Russ Braun from Aftershock called Jimmy's Bastards.
I'm very familiar with it because it was actually long story short, Garth and I had a discussion about this, and I actually pitched a series, not called Jimmy's Bastards, it was called Spy Girls, and it was about the daughters of James Bond.
Oh, gotcha.
And I had it sold at I had it sold with a company, and it was actually supposed to be a TV show where Leslie Nielsen plays the older James Bond. And all his daughters show up at his house one day and say, okay, you know, you're responsible for us. But anyway, right. When Garth was doing the Jimmy's Bastards, I was like, oh, there's that concept again.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it's fun, you know?
Yeah. It's really fun. And it's a great series, but the main character, we're always at the surface of him. I mean, we get a little bit into him, you know, throughout the story, you know, when he finds out he, you know, has fostered all these people and such, but we're on the surface. And so when I first started reading John Pyle, I thought, oh, are we going to go down that path? And then in the first issue, we've already got what feels like a character arc. We've already got character growth to me when he meets Dina, and we can see that, okay, right away, there's something about her that to him, he's like, okay, this isn't just a job anymore. You know, and right. So I feel like we already got another layer, you know. So
yeah, because it's like John is like, he wants to just do the gig and get out where mm-hmm. it's safe. And right. In all the flashbacks of the killings, they're all in and out gigs, right? He doesn't have to get involved. But he, in order for him to get close to her, he has to set up a situation where she needs him, his help. And when doing that, it shows her vulnerability, and he can't blow that off so quick.
Right.
Because everything about him is people being tough and people being stronger. And here she's worried about her dog, and she's that this is going on, and he plays her. But then he realized, okay, I'm playing somebody, but she's a real genuine person. Like this is not a person that's trying to take me out, take me down, destroy me, abuse me, or use me. This is a person who's a genuine person. Like, how am I going to deal with this now? And so there has to be that growth, right? Because there has to be growth in both of them. You know, but it's sort of what makes him likable.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second issue, we see a little bit more of his past. What he went through, why he has a little bit of trauma, and why he keeps everybody at a distance. And then in the third and fourth issue, we realize that, okay, John's making a connection and realizing all these people that he's working for, they're not as important as he should be to himself. And there's a little bit of growth there. But I mean, that's the character arc of each. Each character needs to have a character arc. Otherwise, there's no story.
Right.
And you and I both have read a lot of books where there is no story. It's just like
action scene after action scene.
Yeah. Or they write them like a cardboard character. You know, I'm the tough guy, but I got a heart. That's great. But I need to know why you have a heart. Mm-hmm. But I also need to know why you're a tough guy.
Yeah.
Like what made you tough? And, because I have to, you write from yourself. So I look at myself as like, I view myself as a strong person when I have to be a strong person, but I have a lot of empathy for other people. Meaning I people tell me what they're going through. I put myself in their situation, and I'm not the guy that you tell me you had you hurt your leg and it's been bothering you, or you have, you know, this. I'm not the guy that says, well, it could have been worse. Both your legs could have broke, or yeah, you know, whatever. That's not empathy. You know, empathy is not helpful. No, empathy is, man, that must be really hard for you. You know, that really must be tough. Man, I don't know how you do that, but that must really be tough. That's connecting, and that's empathy. And that's where characters, when you write them, need to go. The surface stuff is, you know, it doesn't leave a lasting thing. I see a lot of movies I love. I like the idea, but I don't love the idea. Like, I don't fall in love with the characters. And then you see a movie and it's like, you want 800 more movies with those two characters.
Yeah.
Because there's some connection that's just wonderful, you know? And that's the difference between great writing and okay writing. You know, I think the connection is very important.
Yeah, well, it's that connection and us connecting to the character, the characters connecting to each other. It's what mirrors our actual lives, right? It's why it sucks that we don't get to go to any conventions right now, because I'm a big believer that everybody has a story. Everybody's been through stuff. I love hearing people tell me their stories. What made you a comic fan? You know, maybe a struggle that you got through made you the person you are. That's what's so great. And I think it is what's kind of the toughest part about this whole pandemic and being stuck inside. But at least we can do things like this, thanks to technology, where we can at least connect on some level.
That's true. That's true. And this is a great technology. I mean, you know, this is a families are connecting where they mm-hmm. never, you know, let's be honest, families, you hear from on your birthday, the holidays, yeah. Like families are now connected. Amanda's family does a whole Zoom with, like, you know, 8 of them every Saturday at 7 o'clock, you know?
Oh, that's cool.
So it's really nice to see people connecting. Also, this, you know, this stuff is really, you know, made people realize how important entertainment and art is mm-hmm. in our lives. Because take away your TV, take away your art, take away your reading, what is your life about? You know, and I think this COVID stuff, it really made people appreciate art, I think, because, you know, we're all hustling for money, 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 but at the end of the day, what do we do with our money? You know, right. It made people appreciate TV and film and stories. And, you know, it's really interesting because I see, you know, a Salvation Army and a lot of these places are full. They have too much stuff because people are just getting rid of things, you know. Yeah. And so it's a very interesting thing. And we see what's really important to us is connections, you know, people connections and, you know, day to day stuff. And of course, food. But it's really funny about, because everyone's learning what they really don't need.
Right.
You don't need 2 houses.
No. Nope.
You don't need a big boat, and you don't need 7 cars, and you don't need a lot of stuff. But I do need my new comics. I do need to watch that cool movie. I do want to read that new book. I want to listen to my family and interact and so it's an interesting time, or politics, right? I'm interested in politics because it's in my face every day.
Yeah,
you know, it's just an interesting time. It's a good time to be a writer because there's a lot of observation going on. There's a lot of that to be sorted through.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely have been buying more back issues than I have in a long time. Number one, because I want to support, you know, comic shops that may be sure. struggling, but I'm stuck inside, and so it's like, well, what am I going to do? Well, let me, you know, I never did finish my Amazing Spider-Man run. Let me go look. So I've noticed on Twitter, you've been filling out some runs. What have you been buying lately?
Yeah, my Fantastic Four run, because, I don't have 1 to 20, okay? Because I just can't afford that stuff.
Right.
But I do have like 20 up, right? And so mm-hmm. I have a board that has the numbers somewhere back here. Oh, I also bought a Fantastic Four omnibus. I'm showing it even though you guys can't see it. I bought it because it covers 1 through like the issues I don't have. So I'm like, okay, I have my omnibus because I'm not going to pay 50 grand for number one. And right. Forget that. Okay. Yeah. But I did fill out, like, I still don't have like the Galactus Surfer issues because they're like thousands of dollars, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just, I'm not in a place to buy them. But I did fill out a lot of weird issues that I'm missing. And, you know, it's kind of fun to be the collector again. And I also collect like 1950s and 1960s Superman and Wonder Woman comics. But what happened with that is the Wonder Woman movie, and everybody now has buying things. The prices have gone through on everything. There is nothing cheap out there. There used to be, I used to find some bargains like Wonder Woman number 100 for like, you know, $30 to $40, $60. Not in great shape, but who cares?
Yeah.
Now it's like crap, like 1.5 on the CGC, and it's like $2,000, and I'm like, what? Get out of here. I'm like, that's like barely, that box is holding the comic together at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
So everything's gotten expensive, but I do like my back issues, and let's be honest, we do want to have the stuff we grew up with. We have this fascination with, you know, so I've been filling out, you know, my office is in a comic book shop. So I just go in the room and I go, hey, you got this copy? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, get that for me. If somebody comes in, make sure that's for me. I'm lucky that way, you know, but I still pay rent. So, you know, I have to be careful when I buy from them. They have so many great comics that I'm like, oh, look at that. It's Wonder Woman 1. Don't you want to give that to me? Because I'm Jimmy Palmiotti? No, it doesn't work like that.
You know. Yeah, actually, when this madness first started, and I thought, okay, well, the economy is going to take a downturn like it did. I remember in 2008, prices for a lot of comics came down. And so I was kind of, there was a few things I'd been looking, you know, for a while. Amazing Spider-Man number 28, that great black cover with Molten Man. I've been looking for that forever. And I'm like, okay, the price is going to come down. And instead, everything shot up. People at home, the people that you know, were fortunate enough not to lose their jobs, stuck at home buying comics. And then I also heard that a lot of people, they took their money out of the stock market because there was so many ups and downs, and they were investing in things like collectibles because it's a tangible asset.
Yes.
And so it had the other effect. So I know exactly what you're talking about with those Wonder Woman issues. It's like all of a sudden,
So
I did, but I did get one though. I did get one for in my price range. That's it presents really well, but it's not going to grade as well as it looks because whoever had it previously, Tyler or something other, he signed his name in ballpoint pen on the inside.
Yeah,
of the front
that
page.
That happens a lot. I used to. When me and my friends would share comics, I put my initials on the back cover, JP, so we know where the comics went.
Right.
It was before all the collecting and everything, But I mean, look, I collect original art. You know, I have a lot of comic art, and that's gone up like crazy. It's just people at home and they're bored, so they're buying things. I got to say, like my paperfilms.com site, I have been selling a lot of stuff. Because people want comics. So, and you know, when you buy it from me, I sign them. So it's like, I got a lot of people buying back issues and stuff that I have on my site, and they're buying artwork. And, you know, I'm really happy about that because I get to send the packages out, you know, you get to use the post office. And I'm happy people are buying stuff. I just want to make sure people are eating and not buying comics. So, look, my buddy's comic store is busier than it's ever been. You know, so go figure. It's in Clearwater. It's called Emerald City in Clearwater, and it's just amazing. But you know, it has to do with people aren't spending money on vacations, and they're not buying gas for their cars, and they're buying is food, and they already have their movies and they already have their cables. So it's like comic books.
Yeah, I mean the only positive of not going to San Diego Comic Con this year is I didn't spend the money that I would have spent.
Yeah, no kidding. I think it's just a hotel room alone. Yep. To be honest with you, that always like, you know, that's like $3,000 for me and Amanda, you know, and we're always like, how are we going to make that money back?
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of cons, I did promise one of our followers that I would ask you, he was curious, what is your craziest con fan experience off the top of your head?
Crazy.
Or weird or fun, just one that whatever the one that stands out in your mind.
We've had people get married in front of us at a con. Amanda and I had like a couple had somebody come and marry them in front of us at the booth. So that was kind of cool. We had a woman in I want to say it's Detroit who had a hot dog in a glass case and had everybody sign the hot dog. That was pretty weird. I remember I did a signing at the Virgin store in New York City. with Glenn Danzig. Glenn Danzig and I did a signing together. And that was interesting because we were signing a lot of boobs. I got to be honest. Comic people don't get that, but rock and roll guys definitely do. Yeah. That was pretty strange. I tell you, most of my experience has been great because I think comic fans are like, you know, Amanda and I, you already know this. Amanda and I love seeing everybody and we mm-hmm. love the fans. And we definitely do slow our line down and talk to people all the time because I feel like if I'm there, the least I can do is chat with right. everybody. So we just have so many great experiences. God, I remember one time, I did a con. This is on me, but I did a con in Philly and I said I would give a free sketch to anybody that brings me a Philly cheesesteak sandwich. And I put that online and 30-something cheesesteak sandwiches later, I fed the whole artist alley. I fed everybody got a cheesesteak. I was drawing away. And so I'm careful of what I say. Like sometimes I do like, hey, if you bring me a dozen donuts, I'll do whatever drawing you want. And
yep.
But I just feed everybody. We just give it out to everybody. You know, it's not like I'm going to eat them all. You know, right. I eat one and I'm like happy as a clam. But just the fun of it and the community, you know, the community, comic book community, they're such nice people. They really are sweet. Nice people, and you know, anybody that's ever met Amanda at a con, you know, Amanda's probably the most present person you'll ever talk to. When you talk to her, you're the only person in the world.
Yeah.
It's because she hyper focuses as well. So, you know, so we really love the cons. We miss them. We have a lot of stories. Mostly, you know, I remember we were stuck in Dallas. Our flight got canceled after a con. And we were like stuck in a hotel room. And we said, if there's any comic fans, we put it online. If any comic fans want to go out to dinner with us, we'll pay for dinner, but come pick us up and take us somewhere to your favorite restaurant. And this guy, James, came with his car and he's like, I'm going to take you to my favorite restaurant. And, you know, we paid for dinner, but it, like the three of us, we hung out and had a nice dinner and we were chatting and, you know, it was a lot of fun. Amanda and I talked about would be fun one day. It's like, and to tape it is like if we can Twitter across the United States and drive and see people can put us up for the night.
In that would be awesome.
If we say like, hey, we're heading into this town. If anybody in this area, if anybody wants to put us up for the night, you know, we'll chip in for dinner or we'll hang out or do a drawing for you. Or if you can just give us a couch or a guest room or a basement with a sleeping bag and like, and videotape it all, you know, so we can do like an hour film of it when we're done of us, you know, destroying people's lives from East Coast to West Coast.
You could get a great web series out of that. Yeah, that would be perfect.
I mean, I don't know how interesting it would be, but it would be fun.
Yeah, you know? It would be. Well, if you ever do that, my door is wide open. I have creators that come for the Phoenix Comic Con that have stayed or just Jason Inman, who I know you know, and his wife, Ashley Victoria Robinson, they came and stayed for a few days. We did New Year's Eve together last nice. Year. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, you're right. I mean, the comics community, it's a family, and yeah, it's great to be a part of for sure.
You got a lot of nice artwork on your walls. I'm looking at the
I do.
Beautiful Moon Knight behind your head, and the
yep.
I see some Star Wars, maybe Star Wars thing. I can't tell.
Actually, if you're looking at that one that's in the middle by the door, that is a Taskmaster from Mark Brooks. But do you remember he did those Tron-inspired covers a few years ago?
Yep.
Yeah, so that is a Mark Brooks Tron-inspired Taskmaster that I had to do for me at San Diego.
Very cool.
And then above that is one of Victor Bogdanovich's pages from the Deadshot, Suicide Squad Deadshot series he did.
Nice.
That is Richard Friend inked it, and it's Deadshot's first ever kill.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, like you know, I've got a few things that original artwork that's
oh, my God. I've been putting stuff away because we have hurricanes down here, so I have to make sure everything's in these waterproof containers. I have a stack of art over there. I'm like, your head would explode. Even though people can't see it, let's see if I can find what I got right here.
All right, let me see it.
is I've been moving stuff around the house, and I'm like, okay, I have to move this stuff. Hang on. Okay. Just a couple of things. Okay. Of course, there's always a man to work here, right? There's always, this was one of her covers for Harley.
Oh, yeah, yep, yep.
Or, oh, that's not PC. Yeah, this was a, yeah, she did like a wraparound two-tier Ivy Harley cover. This is a thing Jansen and Joe Quesada did, a Ghost Rider from the Marvel swimsuit issue many years ago.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, and I don't have much here. There's a Big Numbers page by Bill Sienkiewicz.
Mm. Nice.
That and Grant Morrison wrote. Yeah, I just have to pack all this stuff away because.
Yeah, you can't be too careful down there.
No, it's the only thing I kind of save in the house is the artwork. Everything else, I'm like, the hurricane's gonna get it. It's gonna get it. Whatever, I can buy it again.
Do you find that your physical books take up a lot of? I mean, I'm sure you could see back here. I've got so many.
I do. I admire your very neat. I do, and especially. Because I do have CGC ones too, because they're right down here and they're very great. They're very cool people. They take up a lot of room. I only have my old books. I don't have newer stuff. I get rid of the newer stuff. I have stuff from the 50s and 60s and early 70s. That's all my collection is.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what to do because, I just got 5 more drawer boxes. And and then back there underneath the cloth is another. My desk that I'm sitting at, it's a 6-foot piece of glass by 3.5 feet, but the actual part of the desk, it's 4 more drawer boxes on each side. So 8 more holding up my desk. And, you know, I buy the new books. I read everything digitally. You know, I get preview copies of just about everything because of the press thing. But it's like, I buy the book, like I buy your books. I buy other books of creators I know because I want to support them. But it's like, I don't read them physically. I read them digitally. So then it's like, what do I do with it? Because I'm running.
I guess have a deal with a comic shop, you know, so you can bring them in and you can trade them for one rare comic, you know, read them and then have a deal and say, look, here's 6 boxes of that. Give me a Spider-Man 11 and good shake, you know. Dan DiDio and I talked about that because Dan has like a billion comics.
Yeah, he does.
I have nowhere near him. Like, I honestly, I've sold my collections over and over through the years. You know, it's once I discovered girls, it like sucked up all my comics. But I do buy the omnibuses, you know, because at least I have reference for them and I can read them. I don't know what to tell you. You got to make buildings out of them. You got to become filthy rich and make another building, I guess. I don't know.
You know the story about Paul Levitz, right? When he built his house, when he put in these giant steel beams because he wanted to have a wall where he could have all his comics, and it wouldn't have been supportable. So he literally got like those giant girders that you see in skyscrapers. Yeah. Paul Levitz has a room in his house built with those to hold all his comics.
I'll tell you a Paul Levitz story. When I was maybe 12, 13, I used to go to a comic store in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue called My Friend's Bookstore. Mm-hmm. And there was this geeky kid that worked there that would get the back issues from you off the ladder and everything, and that was Paul Levitz.
Wow, you've known him for that long, huh?
I didn't know him. He was just a guy that worked there. Years later, he told me, you know, I used to work at My Friend's Bookstore. And I'm like, oh my God, I think you were that guy that was a pain in the ass that would get the books off the shelf. And he's like, I probably was. And I'm like, holy shit. That bookstore burned down. That bookstore had more comics than anything I've ever seen. I bought my FF number one there for $60, and I had like 150 to choose from.
Wow.
Yeah. So that gives you an idea. This store had everything. And it cost me $60.
Tragic.
I remember because I resold it for, I think, around $1,400 and bought a used car.
And you thought you made out well.
I did make out well. But that car brought me a lot of pleasure. You know? I had a lot of fun with that car, so it was worth every dart. Look, it's only paper, folks. You can part with things once in a while. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. You know.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on, Jimmy. It's been so fun chatting with you. I'm so glad we got to do this because I've missed you, buddy. We haven't seen each other this con season.
I know. I'm used to seeing you at least, you know, once or twice a year.
Yeah.
Hopefully next year. Hopefully this COVID thing is, I figure by March, you know, it should be to the point. Look, by the law of averages, by March, it should only be like 1%, you know, whatever. Yeah. Meaning without, if as long as people wear masks, we can get this virus down so it has nowhere else to go eventually.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully, I think by March, I think the winter's going to be a little tough. It's going to be what it look. Right now, 1,000 people a day are dying. It's too much. Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, you know, you and I both are hoping for saner heads to prevail in November and you know, yes. Get somebody a little more responsible in the White House and we can get this thing heading in the right direction.
To my Republican friends, I always say, it's okay if you don't vote for him again. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to not be a Republican anymore. You could stay a Republican, but it's okay if you don't vote for him again because maybe you had relatives that died of COVID. Maybe you have no job right now. Maybe whatever it is, it's okay. It's not, you don't have to do full party. I'm not full party on anything. I always vote for the right person.
Yep, me too.
That I feel is right. I don't play the party thing because the party thing, it's not a football team, folks.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
They're people and they're flawed and they, some of them don't care about anything but themselves, and some are more worried about money and wealth. And you know, you have to kind of go with your gut on this one. I have to respect everybody's right to vote. I just think I always say if I had a boss and the past 4 years he ran my business like this, I would think it's time to get a new boss. Yeah. What's the worst that can happen? I mean, it's not even a big deal. Like, my thing is, he had 4 years, and I don't think it's great now. So let's try somebody else, see what their 4 years like. If it's not great, we'll get somebody else in. You know, if you look at it at that basic nature of the thing, you know, I can't really talk because I've known him my whole life. Mm-hmm. I've went to his birthday party when I was in my 20s.
Yeah, being in New York, yeah.
Yeah, I you know. So I see him for what he is, and I'm not that person. He's if he was my neighbor, I would move, you know. And if he was my boss, I would have quit by now.
Yep, agreed.
And if he was a friend of mine, I would have had some nice talks with him, you know.
Yep.
But some people love him for their own reasons. I don't really get them, but I respect them. But I think it's time to get to change shit up a little bit. This is a tough year, man.
I know. I was telling somebody the other day, 2020 is going to be like the 13th floor in a building, you know, where in the elevator there's no 13. That's going to be like when we look back in history books, can we just erase this one? Just not have it either?
It's true. It was just, you know, it's not only him. It's a lot of bad management. You know, a lot of people forget that, you know, at the end of February, Amanda and I were in London for the Birds of Prey premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And people were wearing masks. And when we got home, I'm like, we better buy some supplies because this is going to get serious.
Yeah.
And I remember they were saying, oh, but we closed the airports to China. We were only able to get. And I said, no. We it's not about that. It's the 3 weeks after where they called all the Americans back from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
That needed to be quarantined.
Yep.
Everyone that came back. So they focused on we're closing the borders and all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but you're not quarantining the people coming back.
Yeah.
And I think that was our biggest flaw. I think people don't focus on that because I remember the airport in Atlanta, International Airport, had 10,000 people waiting to get through customs in mm-hmm. small, tight hallways.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and that is how, you know, I felt like the Andromeda Strain was happening then. You know?
Yeah, I love that movie.
I was like, that's where it's all going to go bad. But I have hope for tomorrow, and I have hope for people get smart enough and start caring about each other and screw politics. Let them fight it out.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
They don't care about us. We don't care about us. We need to take care of each other.
Yep, exactly. So, Jimmy, again, we reminded everybody about Pop Kill 2 ends next Friday. So I'll put a link in the Kickstarter, or a link in the show notes, rather, to the Kickstarter for Pop Kill 2. So everybody, if you want to go check it out. And then also your website, if they want to go and check out a lot of the other work.
Paperfilms.com, paperfilms.com. And yeah, check us out. I'm on Twitter at my name, and I'm on Instagram at my name. So is Amanda, although she never looks at it and never answers it. So. But you can reach me there.
Yeah, and I'll put links to all Jimmy's social media as well as Paper Films in the show notes as well. So
appreciate it.
Again, thanks for joining me, Jimmy. My best to Amanda. Have a great night, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Take care, buddy.
All right, take care, man.
All right.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.